Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, my name is Tracy Morgan, your host here at New Books in Psychoanalysis, and today we'll be speaking to Dr. Stephen Poser about his most recent publication, The Misfits, which looks at the relationship between Hollywood icon Marilyn Monroe and psychoanalytic icon, to some, Ralph Greenson, and really draws an elaborate picture of a psychoanalytic relationship, one that we don't normally see. He's an analyst, Dr. Poser's an analyst, looking at the thoughts and feelings of Greenson as countertransference, and he's studying Monroe and the feelings that she may have induced in Greenson so that he behaved in ways that we might not recognize as psychoanalytic. We're very pleased to have Dr. Poser with us today, and his background is very unique. He has a doctorate in philosophy. He is a licensed psychoanalyst in the state of New York and also a faculty member and training analyst at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies. But he's also a working artist, and he has written art criticism. He paints. He exhibits in one-person and group shows around the country, in fact, internationally. So we're very pleased to have him with us to talk to us about his ideas about what went on in this analysis. So without further ado, we want to welcome Dr. Stephen Poser. Hello, Dr. Poser.
Hello there.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. We're pleased to have you with us today to talk to us about your most recent publication, The Misfit, and which discusses in a fascinating way the relationship between Marilyn Monroe and her psychoanalyst, Ralph Greenson. So I just want to welcome you again. And I have a lot of questions, and we can talk about anything for 50 minutes in the 50-minute hour. Just to set up the interview, two things. One is I'd like to talk to you about the publication specifically, but also because I think it's an interesting piece of psychoanalytic writing, and also that you are really in charge of the writing and research of many analytic candidates at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies, and I know think a lot about writing. I want to spend some time getting your thoughts about new forms of psychoanalytic writing, and of which I think The Misfit is one. So
well, thank you. I mean, it was intended in part to be a contribution to the literature of the psychoanalytic case study, which is one of the areas which I have focused on in my teaching, and I do supervise a lot of the students who are writing their final paper for the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies, which is a single case study. And so I've had a chance to think about it and read a whole, you know, range of material through, not just from the students, but in the literature of the field as well. So I have feelings about psychoanalytic writing and the case study in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And this is quite a case study because it's a case study of two. Many have written about Marilyn and Marilyn Monroe. When you read this, you realize that you're really writing you're bringing the analyst. People don't tend to bring the analyst and the patient to life together.
That's correct. Well, most case studies are written by analysts about their own patients or about a patient that they have access to clinical material.
Right.
About, you know, Freud wrote about his wolf man and his rat man. He never met the wolf man, but he wrote the piece about him.
Right.
And Schreiber, I'm sorry. He treated the wolf man, but he never met Schreiber, but he wrote the piece based on Schreiber's own case study. And frankly, I think that not just in Freud's case, but in the case of very many of the most creative, significant contributors to psychoanalytic thought, that it is the deep study of a single patient that kind of opens up a frame of concepts or of ideas for different kinds of dynamics and mechanisms. Throughout the whole history of psychoanalysis, you find that it's the clinical material that generates the new developments in conceptualization. So I think that's an important thing to know about the field. I mean, we don't work from the top down. We seem to work from the bottom up.
that's true. I was thinking that because so many people have written about Marilyn Monroe, and I wanted to ask you, what does bringing psychoanalytic attention, as you do, to her story reveal? Where do you think it takes us? What does it offer in terms of our understanding of not just her, obviously, but also of Greenson? What does the analyst's attention, when elucidated through writing, what can it do?
Well, you know, Marilyn is often brought forth as a classic example of borderline personality disorder. In fact, you know, if you look at some of the textbooks, you know, she's often mentioned in there. And I felt, you know, and I still do feel that these are some of the most difficult patients we will ever treat. And they cannot be either recognized or treated or understood on the model of the classic neurotic that Freud describes, nor the schizophrenic patient that, you know, we spend a lot of time describing in modern psychoanalysis. That this kind of patient demands another way of behaving, another way of understanding, and another way of trying to endure and structure the treatment in order to be able to get any kind of therapeutic result. So I think one thing you can learn about from Marilyn is that this kind of case demands not just, you know, a lot of, you know, subtle and a clinical skill, but a kind of way of conceptualizing that I don't think Greenson had available to him at the time he treated her. And that's one of the reasons the treatment, you know, kind of fell apart or imploded or whatever, however you want to consider it. It's kind of like a Greek tragedy what happened here. It's a terrible story, really. But what I tried to do in the book was to give some of the theoretical background that at least Greenson consciously invoked in order to justify his way of treating her. And it was primarily based on two things. One was Freud's early thought that you can't treat a psychotic patient with analytic interpretive techniques because it won't work. They can't establish an object transference. That's the Freudian position that that Greenson was taught, and that's the position which he took. The second part of it is that he got involved with Milton Wexler, who had a great deal of experience with psychotic and schizophrenic patients at Menninger Clinic. And from Wexler, he derived the idea of the real relationship as the basic therapeutic alliance that must be engaged with a psychotic or a non-neurotic or schizophrenic patient as quickly as possible, because there was no other way to kind of make contact with them and keep them in some kind of therapeutic relationship to the analyst. So you had, in other words, there was no, really, it comes down to the idea of how do you work with this kind of transference, and what kind of transference is it? And I don't think they had the building blocks for that. That's one thing you can learn. The other thing you can learn from it is that the counter-transference induction with this kind of patient is overwhelming, and the demand to gratify very primitive kinds of emotional needs can very easily completely undo the boundaries of the analytic dyad. Mm-hmm. And Greenson, no matter how smart and brilliant and experienced he was, could not defend himself against that. He just fell into the inductions because he wanted to cure her. He wanted to treat her. He wanted to help her. He wanted to save her.
Right.
And he ended up, you know, kind of, he never got over losing her, really. I mean, it was kind of like losing a child for him, I think, more than losing a lover or something.
It broke his heart. Yeah.
And that's part of the emotional reality of this story and part of the tragedy of this story. Yeah. Whether anybody could have done better, treated her better, I don't know. He was our only male analyst. If you notice, you know, there were four of them. Mm-hmm. He was the first and only man, which, in the story of her life, of course, she had very little in the way of either mother. Her mother became psychotic and was hospitalized, you know, when she was seven, and she rarely saw her ever in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She never knew who her father was,
mm-hmm.
and never met him for sure.
Right.
So what you can learn, I mean, there's a lot of things you can learn from this. You know, one of which may be that some patients can't be helped no matter what you do. I don't know. There's no way of knowing how, if she had been exposed to another form of treatment, it might have come out, but
well, do you think that? I mean, if you, I read the book, I thought, all right. Well, what if Stephen Poser were to supervise, to supervise Greenson on this case, based on, because I think you're very sensitive in the book to the psychoanalytic sort of theory and culture and thinking in which he was, steeped, like we're all steeped. He couldn't see the forest for the trees. I mean, I think today we might think very differently about, adopting a person like this would, we might say that would totally drive them to suicide. that kind of treatment would guarantee their destruction. It would be too much and too overwhelming. You had the chance to supervise Greenson, do you have thoughts about different ways of managing?
Well, I think something along the lines that you just said would be appropriate. I mean, what you think is the best thing that you could possibly do for her is, in fact, the worst thing you could possibly do for her. Because giving the pretense of offering that much unconditional love and protection and support, you know, both on a kind of infantile and on a kind of mature, more Oedipal level, can never satisfy the demand that she is going to be placing on you, and to and on top of the fact that you're bound to fail by disappointing her,
right?
You're bound also to incur that recoil, that preemptive strike against the treatment and against the analyst, which this kind of person, this kind of patient, will inevitably level at you the minute she feels the longings arise. So it's as though in this kind of a configuration, this kind of borderline configuration, the very arousal of longing will transform itself into a kind of hostile, retaliatory hatred.
There's a part in the book where you describe her bringing a sculpture to him, which I think really elucidates this point. It's a sculpture of a man and woman sort of erotically intertwined, and she brings it to him, and this is close to the time, you know, that she really decompensates or is decompensating.
Yeah, very close.
Yeah.
Very close.
Yeah, if she's saying,
right.
If you think
then,
by holding me, I'm going to get better, well, look at this, you know, or something. It was very, very powerful, symbolic message.
That's right, and she becomes very angry at him, and, you know, keeps repeating, well, what does it mean, doctor? What does it mean? Tell me what it means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost in a kind of defiant, confrontational way, mm-hmm. to which he could make no response.
Right.
You know, like, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And we have a... go ahead.
Rostin, who was reporting this story, said that when he witnessed this, he felt that right there and then she was falling apart.
Yeah. You can feel it. It was like a moment of, you know, showing him this symbolic, you know, this man and this woman intertwined, and saying, you know, you can't just intertwine me. You can't love me into being better. If she's not allowed to hate him,
he was deaf. He couldn't understand that.
No, the love that kills.
he thought the ideal analyst was a motherly father figure. For
yeah.
Her.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what he tried to present, and he did what Gabbard calls the disidentification with the aggressor in a kind of total way. He thought he was providing her a compensation for all the loss and abuse and emotional kind of failures that she'd experienced in her whole life, and he was going to sort of repair that by giving her those experiences himself.
Right.
That is a big mistake.
It is. I mean, although, you know, I think one of the most difficult aspects of being an analyst is tolerating being hated. And
right.
You know, so, I mean, we know it now. I think it's much more commonly understood that the hate is important, but... and have supervision that, you know, we don't feel that we're failed because we're openly hated. Certainly in the modern school, I mean, that's, you know, you know the patient is free to feel everything if they can feel, you know, that if they can hate you and love you, you have the sense that, you know, you're moving toward quote unquote cure, maybe even, you know, but
then you've got to deal with the pragmatic aspect of how to manage this kind of demand in the transference,
mm-hmm.
without the patient exploding in rage and just leaving,
mm-hmm.
because most of these most borderline patients leave in a rage,
right?
You know, because they're not going to get what they want,
and they can't handle
really
it when they get
them,
it.
If you really cared about whether they lived or died, you know, and you weren't just a, you know, bullshit artist,
right.
Then you'd do something. You know, it's not enough to, you know, to make them feel that you understand.
Right.
It's not enough.
Right.
That's not enough. It goes much deeper than that. They got to feel wanted and loved. And that was I think that was part of the paper that I was actually most proud of when I described that.
Mm-hmm.
The transference, because It's the primitive and profound depth of I need you to want me, which is both addressed to the infantile mother, to the pre-Oedipal mother that she never really had, and to the Oedipal father that she never really had.
Right.
Both of whom abandoned and rejected her.
Yeah,
so Greenson saw that and he understood it perfectly well, you know. But his idea was that in order to cure her, he would need himself to put to create an object which would repair that, which would provide a compensation and a reparation for those early losses and rejections in himself. Now, how could he? And you can't fault that idea. I mean, really. I mean, and every one of her women analysts certainly tried to mother her.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, including Marion Criss. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this story is how deep it goes into the history of psychoanalysis. I mean, Marilyn Monroe has a direct relationship to Sigmund Freud through the. through this chain of connections.
She's one degree of separation, I mean, from Anna.
I mean, you know, Greenson was a colleague of Anna Freud's. Greenson had Max Schur for his analyst for a while. He was analyzed by Otto Fenichel, who was analyzed by Freud.
By Freud, right.
Anna Freud actually met with Marilyn for at least a few sessions in London. So she was actually in the company of Sigmund Freud's daughter. And then Marion Criss was Sigmund Freud's, like, adopted daughter, because Marion was the child of the family physician of the Freuds.
Was she married to Ernst Criss, to the psychoanalyst?
She was married to Ernst Criss.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay, I didn't know that. I sort of figured as much, but... Mm-hmm.
And Marion Criss was involved in the setting up of the Child Study Center at Yale when she emigrated to New York.
Oh, really? Okay.
So yeah, so she was an early pioneer child analyst and worked with Anna Freud first in the Hampstead Clinic.
Right. Right.
And then came to New York, and then Anna stayed in London. But that brings Marilyn very close into the kind of bosom of the Freud family. I mean, she was almost, you know, as though she were analyzed by Freud himself.
It's very interesting because it does open a window onto psychoanalytic history and theory through. I think what's unique and what I like about what you've written, and I hope that you'll. Full disclosure, Dr. Poser has been an instructor of mine at CMPS, and so, you know, I know him as an instructor and an advisor and. And you've mentioned possibly writing more about other analytic couples, you know, analyst and patient couples. And I think that's a fascinating idea because it does open a window onto how far could Greenson go? What were the constraints of the time? What were his what theoretical frameworks were available? And what could a treatment look like at that time? Do you have other sort of ideas?
Well, it's not so easy to find analytic couples.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very long paper that I came across describing Samuel Beckett's analysis with Wilfred Bion. Now that was
perfect couple. How perfect!
That was a mutually influential relationship.
Whoa.
That occurred very early in Bion's career. I mean, he was only a few years out of school, and he took on Samuel Beckett. And there's a very interesting paper about that in the International Journal.
Waiting for Godot. Wow.
Yeah. As far as other analytic couples, this is not so easy to come across.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not so easy to come across. If you think of any more examples,
someone was speaking to me about Judy Garland.
Marilyn Greenson. Judy Garland.
Well, yeah, here's something interesting is a good friend of mine, Heidi Doro, she was a serious reader, and she knew that I was interviewing you, and she was very excited because she'd read the book, and then she said, oh, you know, I've just read this piece, I think a biography of Judy Garland, and I guess Judy Garland was at Austin Riggs.
Really?
Yeah, and, you know, that was a hotbed of, you know...
That's not surprising to me.
Yeah, well, right, absolutely. And I was thinking, wow, that would be really an interesting...
I've had some thoughts, because the publisher of this book, you know, wanted to know what I thought I might be able to do next, and I've had some... You know, I've been working on a couple of ideas, but one of which I am not going to do is Marlon Brando, who I first thought would make an excellent subject for this, because, I mean, in a way, he was a great theatrical and cinema star. I mean, he was a great artist of the time.
Yeah.
And he was on many, many analytic couches. I mean, mm-hmm. he came out of the same school of performing training that Marilyn did, although he studied with Stella Adler instead of Lee Strasberg, but they were both derivative of Stanislavski and the method.
Right.
Which is basically a kind of emotional recall of one's own experience being used as a kind of fuel and platform for creating the role.
Mm-hmm.
So you go into yourself to find the character.
Not for the faint of heart or the narcissistically vulnerable, that approach, I imagine.
No, no. But the more I got into... And Brando did have a psychotic daughter who committed suicide and a son who committed murder.
Yep.
By killing the boyfriend of his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And it all got very messy. And
sounds
Brando,
Greek, yeah.
It was a mess, but... No, I don't think I'm going to do Brando.
Yeah.
I do have some thoughts about, you know, about psychoanalytic writing in general, and
well, that's, I mean, I really do want to talk to you about it. I was thinking that what you've written goes beyond I think a field that is unfortunately in ill repute, known as psychohistory.
Yeah.
But it does something different than psychohistory, because it's not analyzing the culture through a psychoanalytic lens. It does something different in that it attempts to get closer to the analyst's countertransference and countertransference resistance. And so it's interesting because it reveals, I mean, I think that there's a hunger for the analyst to be revealed in the culture now. You know, we have In Treatment, people seem to love it. You know, love to watch it. You know, can be very uncomfortable as an analyst. Many analysts say, "Oh, I'm very uncomfortable watching that." But there's a hunger to like look further into the analyst, which you do. You know, in your writing.
I appreciate it. That's a compliment.
Yeah,
I did identify very deeply with really with both of them in it,
mm-hmm.
and I mean. Thank God nothing like what happened to him ever happened to me. I mean, if I cared that much about a patient who then went off and killed herself, I don't think it would be very easy to get over it.
No.
On the other hand, I think we've all had patients who arouse feelings of pure, you know, wishing to make their lives better, to help, to give something truly and authentically of ourselves to them, which has nothing much to do with interventions that are technically designed to produce any kind of result, but are more like, you know, gifts from the heart of some kind,
right?
Or feelings, and I think we've all had patients who really we end up caring very much about, if not loving.
Yep.
And I also think that those kinds of feelings can be very important therapeutically. I mean, the tricky part is not to act them out in such a way as to destroy the therapeutic alliance or the relationship in favor of something altogether in the real world, like bringing a woman into your home and
letting her keep champagne in your fridge.
Yeah, or wash the dishes or sleep over and... But it happens. You know, people end up lending money, giving various kinds of job and professional help, you know, even entering into romantic relationships. Now, I don't think that happened between
right.
I think Greenson was much more vulnerable to the homeless waif than he was to the blonde bombshell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, every analytic couple is a unique configuration of dynamics and chemistries, and even of the moment in time in which their lives cross.
Yeah.
And that combined with the school of thought, you know, of which the analyst is somehow a product, will, you know, determine an awful lot of what happens or what doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a kind of uniqueness which I always emphasize, you know, when I'm teaching this stuff, is that every analytic pair is a unique occurrence.
Right.
Even though, you know, they're supposedly, you know, embarking on the same kind of therapeutic journey, there's a uniqueness which can never really be replicated. So every case study is like a unique biography of two.
So let me ask you a question. How would you define? Well, there's two questions. One is I want to ask what's psychoanalytic writing, and I want to ask you what is psychoanalytic research. Big questions.
That's good.
Go ahead.
Well, I can answer the second question. I think I basically know the answer to. At least my way of thinking about psychoanalytic research. Now, you have to remember that I don't teach empirical or quantitative research methods, and I have no real background in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have more of a background in the arts and humanities, and so when I teach the research class, I start out by saying, well, this is about how do you study your patient? How do you make sense of all the different kinds of data that are kind of flying through the room, you know, both in the form of verbal communications and nonverbal communications, you know, daydreams, thoughts, wishes, fantasies, you know, all kinds of bits and pieces of psychic particles, let's say, that then somehow have to conform into some make sense out of this. What's going on here? What's happening? How do you understand this? So the way I try to get the students to begin to write is to first describe the what happens, who says what. What happens next? You know, what are the details? How do they move? How do they, you know, digress? What's the sequence of imagery and of feelings and of and so forth that occurs in the course of just a single session? And then after a while, you want to try and make sense out of it. You have to look for patterns. You have to look for, you know, shapes. And then you can begin to address the question of, like, what's going on here? So first there's the what, and then there's the so what. And it's like narrative and then commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's and then when you get into the structured single case study, you usually have to have a methodology and a review of literature, but the fundamental part of it is to be able to describe. And in the Maryland piece, I put an awful lot of very vivid anecdotal description, almost visual. And a part of the background of this book was that after I did a workshop on borderline personality, I gave my first kind of case presentation of Marilyn. I got introduced to a filmmaker, a French filmmaker, who was interested in making a movie about what happened between Marilyn and Greenson. And so for more than a year, I met with her in the coffee shop, and we just, I mean, I told her everything I could tell her about Borderline based on my own experience. Plus, we were reading some of the biographical material together. And that, you know, so when I got around to making the effort to expand all this into something like a long monograph, I was writing it for her. I was writing it almost as a kind of blueprint for a screenplay or something. And that's why it's so full of anecdotal, visual descriptions, what she says, how she talks, how she acts, what people say. And that gives the richness of detail. And then when I turned to the interpretive side, I had a lot of data upon which to build my comprehension, and I used those bits and pieces of psychoanalytic theory that I felt did in fact explain and make sense of this to the best that I could. So I wasn't, you know, applying a psychoanalytic template to the material. I was evoking psychoanalytic ways of comprehending to the material in a more, holistic and natural way. So does that make sense to you?
Yeah, sure.
So that's my idea. So psychoanalytic research and writing.
I just wanted to say one thing. It's interesting the way you describe research, because, of course, the thought is research, you're going to prove something for all of us that we need to see, right? It sort of has at least to my mind, doing research is creating public knowledge. But when psychoanalysts do research, we're actually not, it's not exactly public knowledge that we're creating, because we're just studying, as you say. I mean, if it is a single case study in that form of research, it is one person at a time. I mean, I'm interviewing next week Muriel Dimon, and she's had a reading and writing group that they have a book called my mind is blanking out. With Culture in Mind, Psychoanalytic Stories, in which many analysts write these sort of interesting stories. But they're looking at sort of what this means about the culture, right? And so that's a different form of, or a different approach, and they're sort of looking outward to the larger world as it intersects with the clinic. And with the case study, it's a very intimate, as you say, a very intimate form of research, and only the analyst knows. You know, only the analyst.
I think so too, because there's a large literature in psychoanalytic research which does try to live up to the objectivity and empirical defendable hypothesis and inference process that you describe. I mean, someone like Andre Green would probably say that there really can't be any such thing as psychoanalytic research, because it's a kind of it's an intersubjective situation to begin with, and there's no outside, you can't repeat the experiment, you know what I mean? And see how it would come out with a different technique, for example, or a different analyst. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can do other kinds of outcome studies, but they won't be let's say, how should I put this? It's very problematic what is or is not psychoanalytic research. You know, what I've been describing is a kind of psychoanalytic writing, a kind of way of using psychoanalysis as a lens through which to try to comprehend a clinical phenomenon. And there are other ways of conceiving research in psychoanalysis which have nothing to do with the understanding of a single case.
Right, and your point that you made, I think, when we began speaking today was that out of the single case can emerge new theoretical understandings, new clinical understandings, understandings that could impact, theory of technique, thoughts about new thoughts about organization of the psyche, the intersubjective. I think that's very powerful. I mean, that out of
Anna O is the first psychoanalytic patient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anna O.
Yep.
gave rise to the conception of the cathartic method and to the idea of making the unconscious conscious as a way of relieving the expression of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is the mother of psychoanalysis, if Freud is the father.
I heard Lou Aaron give a talk at the APA in which he said that he thought Ferenczi was the mother of psychoanalysis and Freud was the father, but which I think is also true.
I think that's also true.
Yeah.
I think that's also true. But if you look carefully at the major figures in the field, and you can start with Freud and go to Ferenczi and go to Klein and go to Jung and go to Spotnitz and go to Bion and go to Winnicott.
And Ogden, right? I mean, Ogden is...
There are key cases...
Right.
That defined their thought at certain crucial moments in the development of their conceptual apparatus,
mm-hmm.
which are decisive,
mm-hmm.
absolutely decisive.
Yeah.
Melanie Klein, I know for sure, because there was one child case that really gave her concept of the
right
the good and bad breast and the so forth the pre the Well, the schizoid mechanism.
The paranoid schizoid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a flip side of my thought also that every major school of analysis is also a self-portrait of the analyst, not just of the patient, but of the analyst.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so you get the, you get the combination of Anna O and Freud, and you get a certain picture, and
mm-hmm.
then the Oedipal conflict as well is partly a bit of Freud's own self analysis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, what's the question?
I don't know. I just was interested in thinking about the how analysts. Create schools of thought. Out of these case studies, certain schools of thought are created, and I was thinking about the concept of thirdness, which now seems to be getting more ecumenical, right? But I mean, does it begin with Ogden or is it with Benjamin? But it comes in Ogden. You're reading a case, and he begins to elucidate, and you begin to get the sense of, well, I kind of buy this thirdness idea, the third in the room, and what is the third? And he brings it to life, and then as clinicians, we sit with our patients and go, "Oh, is this what he means? You know what I mean? Is this what he's talking about?" It's exciting, I think, to learn through people's case studies and theoretical advances made from studying the case closely. Sure.
I often teach a piece by Christopher Bolas called "What Is Theory?"
Mm-hmm.
Says that a theory is a mode of perception,
right?
And that every school of psychoanalysis that you can somehow internalize into your perceptual repertoire adds to the depth of your ability to comprehend a patient and to comprehend the analytic dynamics that are going on between you and that patient.
Mm-hmm.
And he encourages people to have as wide a range as possible, but the thing is, it takes decades to even get one in.
Right.
You really have to live inside these modes of of conceptualization to really be able to see through them.
That's
and
right.
To understand through them. Mm-hmm. And then you have to let go of all the sort of theoretical apparatus and just be there with the patient.
Right.
And I think Greenson tried to do that, except that he was operating, I think, with a flawed conception of what he was dealing with, and also with a very blindsided understanding of his own conduct. He just didn't want to know, for some ungodly reason, what he was doing. And that's the part I don't know. What in him let this happen?
Mm-hmm.
What was he repeating? You know, mm-hmm. what was? Yeah, and that's the part I don't know. You see, that's part of his analysis. I don't know.
And his papers are sealed for quite a while. Is that correct?
Till 2039. And that ain't, you know, whistling Dixie. That, there must be a reason for that. Everybody's going to be dead by then. You know?
That's the hope, I guess.
I mean, it wasn't just to protect patient confidentiality,
uh-huh.
because he's got a lot of papers
sure.
at UCLA, which is where they all are. But every one of the Maryland files is just sealed.
Wow.
So all the stuff that I got, you know, was from other sources, like the correspondence with Anna Freud that mm-hmm. is not in those files.
Mm-hmm.
And different kinds of interviews and recounts from some of the biographical material that I read.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of mystery there. There's a lot of mystery there.
I think it's very difficult. I was thinking to myself, well, gee, if I wanted to write about an analytic, psychoanalytic duo, a couple, it's really damned impossible, pretty much, to get the analyst notes. I mean, they're, you know, confidential. The patient's confidentiality has to be protected, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you know, but it is really. It's compelling literature. It's sort of like you. I had the sense I was reading something. It wasn't prurient in what you wrote, but in a sense, it was like, wow, you're sort of taking us to the other side.
Yeah. Well, I think I did. You know, and I hope people don't feel like voyeurs when they read that thing, because.
I think that that's just me reading it as an analyst, going like. Wow, you know.
Yeah.
Here it all is, you know, these two people.
Yeah.
You know, and their time together. You know, I mean, it was uncomfortable in moments, just like watching. I mean, I, you know, people say watching in treatment is uncomfortable. It's like, that's right, it's uncomfortable of you, you know. As he almost sleeps with the patient, right? And you know the main character, and he, you know, I think punches a patient and push. You know,
oh well, Wexler got thrown out of the Los Angeles Psychoanalytic Association for attacking a patient, and Greenson, who was in the next office, had to go and tear them apart.
Well, I mean,
Wexler was a wild card.
Sounds
he was
it.
A wild card. He was a wild card.
I mean, and Greenson could have chosen a different supervisor. I mean, right? I mean, that's there's a lot of information in like who we go to for supervision, right? And
that's
who?
Right. He could have chosen a different supervisor.
Yeah. We all know, like, you know, if you know who someone's being supervised by, you have, it's a lot of information about the person in their choice of a supervisor. You know,
well,
and.
Yeah.
It's always that way. If you know who someone chose as their analyst, and so I was thinking, well, you know, Greenson, you know, he had other people to choose from, but he chose someone a little, I don't know, maybe a little wild, a little, you know, willing to throw caution to the wind, right? And in a way. Because, I mean, there were other people. I mean, obviously, the moderns always say, well, you know, Spotnitz in the 40s, he was, you know, working with schizophrenics, as was Harry Stack Sullivan, you know, and their approach was quite different, you know, in working with people who were very regressed. And I know your point is she's not schizophrenic, although she had a lot of psychotic features, but that she's more borderline.
That was my main point, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But those psychotic features threw him for... I don't think either of them had the sophistication we have now with regard to those differentiations. I mean, there's more to
mm-hmm.
it's not just you know, neurotic versus schizophrenic.
Right.
You know, he was dealing with a severe character disorder with a lot of psychotic defense organizations, and she could get very primitive. She was capable of delusional transferences, but she was not hallucinating. She wasn't hearing voices. She wasn't treatable as a schizophrenic
mm-hmm.
or as a neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided he was going to treat her basically by not treating her.
Right.
By adopting her.
Right.
That was a big mistake.
I keep thinking, what would I mean, clearly, Kernberg had not made a big impact on the scene in thinking about borderlines. Whether you agree with his approach or not, it really is the antithesis, as you think of it, to what Greenson did, what Wexler, you know, suggested as a supervisor.
Yeah,
you know, Kernberg's approach is so highly structured and so...
That's right.
You know, so bounded and boundaried. I mean, that it's a... you understand, maybe it's a reaction to...
Yeah. And they don't hesitate to hospitalize people very easily, you know, in that school of thought as well.
Right.
And Greenson wouldn't do that with her.
Right. He wouldn't hospitalize her. Right. And she was...
He wouldn't, you know, whereas I think a Kernberg would have hospitalized her.
Well, when she was hospitalized, she really wanted to...
She freaked out.
...burn the house down. You know, she burned the relationship to the ground, classically, right? She excoriated. Which analyst was that? That was Chris who had her hospitalized. I forget, but it was scorched earth after then. So then you lose the patient. You know, you save them, but you lose them potentially.
So that's you know, that remains a problem. No matter who you are, you know, you're more likely to lose a patient like this than you are to help them.
Yep.
No matter what. And, you know, my frank opinion is that that's still true of schizophrenia as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are people who are talented with this, you know, and I don't know where they are or who they come from, but some people can get it
mm-hmm.
with somebody like this, and Greenson wasn't one of them. I don't think he was tough enough for her, basically.
Right. Not at all.
But he had a lot of vanity and arrogance about him, and that's part of the reason he took Wexler for a supervisor, because Wexler complimented that. I mean, they both, you know, thought that they knew better than everybody else.
They're a folie à trois.
Yeah, yeah.
The supervisor, the analyst, and the patient can form that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, so we're at 50 minutes. Is there anything else that you wanted to say or talk about before we draw the interview to a close? It's been a pleasure having you here. So,
well, it's been a pleasure talking. I don't know. Well, what would you like to know? Or what's your burning question that you still haven't answered?
I'm looking. I mean, I like that you listen. I just want it's not really a question. It's like a leading question. But I notice, of course, The Misfits is plural.
The Misfits was the movie.
But isn't that plural? And I think the book is The Misfit. Is it The Misfit or The Misfits? I have in my mind.
Misfit. The book is The Misfits, and it's available only as an e-book on Amazon.
Right.
Don't look for it in a bookstore. It's only available on Amazon, but it's very cheap, so that's a nice compensation. You can download it to your
You could download it even as you're listening.
To your computer, to your iPad, your smartphone, or your Kindle. Free.
Here's the thing that I was thinking, though. It's like it's such a great title that you chose, because
I didn't choose it.
No,
it was chosen by the people that published it.
Oh, really?
They also got a great cover picture, which still from the Misfits, the movie. But they gave it the title. I had a much more kind of prosaic academic title.
What was the title?
Final Analysis.
Isn't there a movie?
Final Analysis. The story
with Mickey Rooney or something? No.
They didn't like that very well, so they came up with a better title.
But I think
it's a good title because it's not just her. It's the two of them.
That's right. Together. I love that. I actually really got a kick out of the title. I was like, well, that's kind of a great description of...
So that was not my doing, but I loved it. When I heard it, I thought, this is great.
Yeah. People know the movie and associate her with it, and now to bring that to an analytic pair was terrific.
Yeah. So there's the analytic pair. So if you think of any... good analytic pairs.
I think you should go for Judy Garland. I really would like to see.
Help me find out who treated her, and then we can go from there.
Well, I'll work on that. I think it would be. She's another fascinating and tragic figure, and she has family that are alive actually, so it'd be pretty tricky. But
okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thank you for being with us. Keep us posted regarding your next publication, and we'd be happy to have you come join us again. And I'd like to thank Dr. Stephen Poser for speaking with us today about his book, The Misfits, which is, as he said, you can download it from Amazon. And thanks for spending time with us. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.